This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Last time on the Antiques Radio Show, we discussed a bronze bowl for balls, a Chinese censer someone kept tennis balls in and which sold for nearly 6 million Australian dollars. This time we toss over six more balls, or is it one ball six times? And a debate about them. We'll badger you with some stuffing and give you an incredibly expensive haircut before scrolling down to Esther. We answer the question of what a queen collects and suggest a museum you shouldn't visit. Big Brother in art trivia? Stay tuned. And our opening salvo comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 15th of June and is written by Alex Capon. Why the saga of the £22,000 Sobers 6-6s ball isn't over. New evidence has emerged in the long-running 6-6s cricket ball saga. Footage of a Sir Garfield Sobers interview has been broadcast, in which the cricketer says that only one ball was used when he became the first batsman to hit 6-6s in one over in first-class cricket in 1968. When a ball purporting to be that used for final delivery was knocked down at £22,000, that's £26,400 including buyer's premium, round about 50,000 Australian dollars, at a Christie's South Kensington sporting memorabilia sale in November 2006, the catalogue stated that three separate balls were used in the over. As soon as 3 weeks after the auction, The Independent reported that doubts had arisen about the make of the ball sold. The ball that was sold was made by Duke & Son, but officials and former players at Glamorgan Cricket Club, where Sobers had achieved his famous feat, insisted that the Welsh county used only balls made by Stuart Surridge at the time. A recent report about the controversy was aired on BBC's Wales Live to coincide with the start of the ICC Cricket World Cup on May the 29th. In the programme, the bowler of the over, Malcolm Nash, stated again that only one ball was used and the ball he bowled was made by Surridge. The broadcast also showed previously unseen video footage of Sobers at Glamorgan's St Helens ground in 2006, the year of the CSK sale, discussing the 6-6s over with former Glamorgan player Roger Davis. ATG asked Christie's about the Wales Live broadcast and the newly released footage and received the following statement. We are satisfied that no mistake was made by Christie's and we have no further evidence to assist in relation to the ongoing inquiry. For Christie's full statement and more on this story, visit https://atg.news/66s. And thank you, ATG, for that ongoing controversy. And if that story hasn't bowled you over, this might knock you over. This comes also from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 24th of June. Fur flies in taxidermy oddity. Boxing badgers is one of just two known occasions when the celebrated taxidermist Peter Spicer, 1839 to 1935, ventured into the strange world of the anthropomorphic tableau. Working from his landmark shop in Leamington Spa during the late Victorian and Edwardian era, Spicer consistently produced cases of the highest quality, admired for their naturalistic poses and settings. The only Spicer cases that show animals posed in human activities and imbued with human characteristics are a mount made as a tribute to Walter Potter's famous tableau, The Death of Cock Robin, and this pair of pugilistic badger cubs. Purchased by the vendor at auction in the 1970s for £21, the 2'7", that's 78 centimetre, case depicts the two now slightly faded mammals going glove to glove against the backdrop of grasses, bracken and a finely painted woodland scene. Spicer's trademark, a large pebble carrying a painted signature, appears in the foreground to the floor of the case. Anthropomorphic taxidermy, the macabre 19th century craze that was popular with Queen Victoria herself, has a narrow but dedicated 21st century collecting base. Offered at Tennant's Natural History and Taxidermy Sale in Leyburn on June the 14th, with an estimate of £3,000 to £5,000, the boxing badgers sold to a UK private collector at £14,000, plus 20% buyer's premium. And there's a rather wonderful picture of the two boxing badgers included in this Antique Trade Gazette article. Now, badger hair is valuable for shaving brushes, but here's something even more valuable in the haircut scene. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 29th of June. Beethoven relic locks in at £28,000 result. Locks of Beethoven's hair are known to have been taken from the composer on his deathbed in 1827. But an earlier and substantial sample featured in a recent London sale, sold for £28,000 at Sotheby's, with varying buyer's premium, against an estimate of £12,000 to £15,000, it's certainly a well-documented souvenir. The pianist and composer Anton Halm, 1789 to 1872, first met Beethoven in 1815, and it seems the two men got on well together. Beethoven liked Halm's bluff military manner and apparently bore him no ill will even after his wayward piano playing at the Choral Fantasia in 1817 brought the performance to a halt. Halm later told Beethoven's biographer, A.W. Thayer, that while making an arrangement for two pianos of Beethoven's Grosse Fugue, Opus 133, in 1826, he had asked Beethoven's factotum, Karl Holtz, to secure for his wife, Maria, a lock of his master's hair. The locks duly appeared, but Halm subsequently discovered that he'd been deceived, though whether Holtz was the culprit, or, as some have suggested, it was the composer himself, will never be known. In any event, Beethoven proclaimed his anger that his friend had been so treated, telling Halm, "See what terrible creatures I am surrounding by, whom respectable people should be ashamed to be with. You've been given the hairs of a goat." As the story goes, he promptly snipped off some of his own hair and gave it to Halm. The locks were later given to Halm to his pupil Julius Epstein and had remained in his family until this summer. Sotheby's did not reveal any details about the buyer. And the sum total price, incidentally, of that haircut was something in the region of $60,000 Australian. And we now scroll through the pages of the same Antique Trade Gazette of the 29th of June, and we come to page 15, and this item. Esther Scroll with £25,000 golden touch. Topping by some way an offering of 300 pieces of jewellery at Lan and Turnbull's 25% buyer's premium Edinburgh sale was a Persian gold and niello decorated Esther Scroll. The 6.5-inch, that's 16.5, long holder with coral finial enclosed a Megillah scroll engraved with river landscapes. This told in Hebrew the story of Esther, wife of Emperor Xerxes, who stopped a plot to exterminate her fellow Jews in Persia. Traditionally, the scroll is read out on the Jewish feast of Purim. The Edinburgh piece was unmarked, but testing at the Edinburgh Assay Office showed it to be 18 carat gold. Precise dating was more difficult. The auction house reckoned the mid-20th century, but others thought the scroll, if not the niello work, was earlier. One or two such Megillahs have come on the market since a silver gilt example took a 5x estimate £11,000 at Lawrence of Crewkerne 6 years ago. The example at Edinburgh on June the 5th was pitched at £5,000 to £8,000 and sold at £25,000, which is roughly $50,000 Australian, all up with buyer's premium. Now, we had some controversy or disagreement over the cricket balls bowled to Sir Garfield Sobers. We now here have academic debate over the Esther Scroll. And a letter written to the Antique Trade Gazette slightly later on the 6th of July reads as follows. Scroll probably Iraqi, not Persian. Madam, the Niello designs on the Persian Esther scroll sold at Lan and Turnbull, ATG number 2398, indicate that, in my opinion, it is likely to be Iraqi work rather than Persian. Similar designs are frequently found on small 20th century Iraqi silverware, such as napkin rings. The building on the left of the scroll holder is the Arch of Khosrow in ancient Ctesiphon on the river Tigris, some 20 miles from Baghdad and across the river from Hellenistic Seleucia. The palm trees and sailing boats are also typical Iraqi Niello motifs. The tombs of the prophets Ezra and Ezekiel are both located in modern-day Iraq, and there was a thriving Jewish community in Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq until at least the early 1950s. And the letter was written by Anthony Lewis of Ealing, London. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. Turning to something less controversial and a little more regal. So what do queens collect? Or at least a queen, or a member thereof? Take Brian May. You may recall him sometimes described as the guitarist of Queen, who wears a Charles II wig. Well, if we turn to the Antique Trade Gazette of the 4th of May, we see a beaming picture of the same gentleman, and the headline, May Turns Up the Stereos. Queen star is also a huge Victorian photo fan. And this piece was written by Joan Porter. Back in the day when rock stars set their trousers and instruments alight on stage, Queen guitarist Brian May was busy buying Victorian photographs. He dived around junk shops, bid at auction, and waded through thousands of boxes at fairs and markets. May now has one of the largest collections of Victorian stereo photographs in the world. His firm, the London Stereoscopic Company, LSC, is one of the exhibitors at Photographica. This annual classic camera fair is organised by the Photographic Collectors Club of Great Britain and runs on Sunday, May the 19th at the Royal Horticultural Hall in London. May's business can trace its roots back to Oxford Street in 1854 when the London Stereoscope Company was born. By 1856, the company had changed its name to the London Stereoscopic Company, and finally in May 1859 assumed the name it was to retain for years to come, the London Stereoscopic and Photographic Company. May's firm states, their business was selling stereo views and viewers to the public, and they were leaders in a boom, a craze, which swept England, Europe, and eventually the US too, of stereo photographs of every conceivable subject, which, viewed by means of a stereoscope, presented scenes in lifelike three dimensions. In a world which had never experienced television, the movies, or the internet, this was understandably a revelation. May and fellow enthusiasts and scholar Dennis Pellerin had revived the LSC in 2008. And staying with Queen, the Mercury now rises to the art newspaper of July and August, and in the section In the Frame we have a picture of Freddie Mercury, and the piece reads as follows. Freddie's sister promises a touch of magic. Interesting to hear from Freddie Mercury's family how much they appreciate his eye for detail and for beautiful things. His sister, Kashmira Bulsara, recounts in the latest V&A magazine that he was passionate about antique pieces. The Queen frontman bought two console tables, for instance, which his mother kept in storage. She didn't mind this at first, but ended up keeping them for more than 2 years in her bedroom at her small Feltham home, Kashmira Bulsara says. and now she's made a loan and promised a gift to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London of 49 exquisite Art Deco vanity cases by designers such as Cartier, La Cloche-Frère and Van Cleef & Arpels, which she collected in Freddie's memory. The elegant cases made for holding cigarettes and makeup are on show in the revamped William and Judith Bollinger Gallery at the V&A Rock and Roll. And staying with museums, but moving to Australia, here's a museum you definitely don't want to visit, and here's why. And this piece comes from the Daily Telegraph of the 26th of July. Year off for big museum makeover, writes Jocelyn Aerith. The Australian Museum is about to close its doors for 12 months as the Sydney CBD building undergoes extensive renovations. Headed by Neeson Murcutt and Cox Architects, the long-awaited redevelopment will allow the museum to host and bring more major international touring exhibitions to Sydney. A whopping $57.7 million budget has been put towards the museum makeover, including $50.5 million from the New South Wales government and $7 million still to be raised. New South Wales Art Minister Don Harwin announced yesterday that renovations will commence on Monday, August the 19th, and that Sydneysiders and tourists will have to wait up to 1 year for construction to finish. The project will extend the museum's exhibition halls, a massive 1,500 square metres across two levels. The building will also host brand new education facilities, members' lounge, gift shop and cafe. The Australian Museum hopes to reopen its doors in early 2021. And as you probably know, the Australian Museum is in College Street alongside Hyde Park in Sydney's CBD. We wish them well with their renovations. It was always a great institution, and no doubt it'll be even better when it reopens in due course. And we turn now to the Art newspaper for some slightly controversial issues. They have an excellent section in their publication called Global Briefing, and here are two stories from a July-August issue. The first is entitled YouTube Removes Historic Depiction of Nazi Rally. The video sharing platform YouTube, which is owned by Google, introduced new guidelines in an effort to combat hateful and supremacist content. The crackdown led to the immediate removal of the full version of Leni Riefenstahl's 1935 Nazi propaganda film Triumph of the Will, which depicts the Nuremberg rally of the previous year. The film website IndieWire noted that Riefenstahl's epic is an essential look at the ideological power of the moving image and how it can be co-opted on a mass scale, and that it has been taught in universities for decades, and not because professors hope to advance the horrific mindset of the Third Reich. And our second controversial item from Global Briefing: New York Times bans political cartoons. The New York Times announced that it will stop publishing political cartoons in its international edition. The decision followed widespread condemnation of an anti-Semitic caricature that appeared in the newspaper in April. This depicted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a guide dog with a Star of David attached to its collar, leading a blind US President Donald Trump, who is shown wearing a yarmulke, the skull cap worn by Jewish men during prayer. The New York Times apologised for the cartoon, describing it as clearly anti-Semitic and indefensible, but has now gone much further by banning political cartoons altogether. The decision was described by The Guardian as a sinister and dangerous overreaction, while The Washington Post warned that cartoons are democracy's canary in a gold mine. Controversy can also relate to museum and exhibition exhibits. And staying with the Art newspaper for the June edition on page 7, Migrant Boat at Venice Biennale. the Swiss-Icelandic artist Christoph Buchel unveiled a rusting fishing boat that sank in the Mediterranean in April 2015 as a public work of art in the latest edition of the Venice Biennale, which opened last month until the 24th of November. Between 700 and 1,100 migrants travelling from Libya to the Italian island of Lampedusa are believed to have drowned on board the vessel after it collided with another ship. Its inclusion in the contemporary art show was widely condemned as exploitative, not least because the artist chose to display no accompanying information or label near the boat, so that many visitors passed by it without knowing of the tragedy that unfolded there. The Biennale's artistic director, Ralph Rugoff, said he intends to add a label to the display very soon. And now, lightening the mood just a little, we turn to some information from www.news.artnet.com from November the 28th, 2018. I think the information is still current, and we had there a list of the most expensive items that had ever been auctioned. And here we have the most expensive diamond. I wonder what you think this went for. Most expensive diamond, the CTF Pink Star. Price? Wait for it, $71.2 million. That's approximately 100 million Australian. When? April 2017. Where? Sotheby's Hong Kong. Why? The CTF Pink Star is the largest internally flawless pink diamond that the Gemological Institute of America has ever graded. The ring-mounted 59.6-carat diamond was mined in 1999 by De Beers in Africa and measures 1.06 inches by 0.81 inch. It was renamed the CTF Pink Star after the Hong Kong conglomerate Chow Tai Fook Enterprises, which also has a chain of jewellery stores, bought it and changed the name in honour of the owner's father. Previously, the same stone was hammered down with premium for $83 million at Sotheby's Geneva in November 2013, but the buyer defaulted on the sale, invalidating the record. I wonder what'll happen to that diamond. Do you think it'll get mounted in a ring and there'll be some incredibly lucky young lady being offered it, and marriage as well? We'll have to follow the media reports and hope that the story ends up with everyone living happily ever after. Now, let's turn to the word curfew. C-U-R-F-E-W. Curfew. What does a curfew mean to you? As a child, did it mean that mother said you had to be in bed by a certain time? Did it mean that civic authorities would arrest you if you were on the streets after dusk? Well, did you know it's also an object? A dome-shaped device with a handle on top, rather like a giant meat cover. I'd like to read from page 107 of a wonderful book I'm reading. It's called The Arts of Living, Europe 1600 to 1815, by Elizabeth Miller and Hilary Young. And in relation to the curfew, they write, in a northerly climate, keeping warm was a major preoccupation during the colder months. The shiny semicircular object in the hearth is a curfew from the French couvre-feu, or fire cover, a brass guard that could be placed in front of the fire at night to prevent sparks escaping and to keep the embers alight until morning. And there's a picture of the item in the book. The origin of the word, of course, goes back a very long way and relate to fire being such an important source of light and heat and vital to a winter's evening and night. No wonder it comes to be associated with defining when one could and could not do things, especially nocturnally. Hence, a curfew. In a previous programme, we talked about terminology, and the Antique Trade Gazette has some very useful glossaries of terms, And I would like to read a few more items. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 6th of July. And it's really quite useful to know what the terminology is, what the jargon and lingo is used by collectors, dealers, museum people, auctioneers, etc. And here's one term, fine art. Fine art refers to visual art production primarily for aesthetic purposes. It generally comprises paintings, watercolours, drawings, photography and sculpture. However, many auction houses describe some of their sales as fine art auctions, simply to distinguish them from general sales, to imply the lots on offer are of higher value. So what then does the Antique Trade Gazette say about decorative art? This term refers to three-dimensional antiques, including ceramics, glass, silver and furniture, that serve a decorative as well as a functional purpose. In this way, it's different to fine art and works of art. And what do we mean by a reserve? When we see an item at auction that has a reserve, what do we mean? Well, the Antique Trade Gazette tells us, reserve. The price agreed between the vendor and auctioneer, below which the auctioneer will not sell the lot. Some vendors agree to sell at the auctioneer's discretion, for example, when it's difficult to set a reserve due to the type of lot being sold. Let's turn to a descriptive term, verso and recto. What on earth do they mean? Well, the Antique Trade Gazette informs us, terms referring to different sides of a picture. Verso refers to the back, while recto refers to the front. For books, the right-hand page of an open book is called the recto, while the left-hand side is known as the verso. And finally, CITES. The United Nations Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna, CITES, controls the trade in endangered species. Its regulations cover parts and derivatives of endangered species, as well as live specimens, and encompasses a range of materials found in antiques and taxidermy, such as ivory, tortoiseshell, and furniture fashioned from some tropical hardwoods. This, incidentally, has serious implications if you're trying to import or export items that have any of these endangered species or parts thereof involved. And very often a CITES certificate is required, and sometimes export or import is actually not even permitted at all. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.